Hey guys, this is going to be a health assessment of the ears, or assessing the ears. We are using the Weber Kelly Health Assessment in Nursing 7th Edition textbook. This is where all the material is coming from, the PowerPoint and the text that I put in. And again, with the AI hosts, just be mindful of like the hashtag thing and the weird names like CNI for cranial nerve 1 or factor XA for factor XA or just random stuff like that. So just be mindful of that. The material is still very good. But again, this is going to be health assessment of the ears.
Oh, boy, got some blood going.
Yeah,
they said with blood. He's wearing it too.
Welcome to the bay. When you get over to the bed, we'll go ahead and give you the story. This is all going to happen super fast. Welcome to the emergency room.
70-year-old female, single driver of a vehicle. Appearance that she went off-road into a ditch, rolled over her car onto a trailer, caved in. The top of the vehicle was caved in, so she was hanging out partially from the window.
So 45 minutes of CPR, no return of circulation. We can stop CPR. 6 over.
Welcome to the deep dive. Today we are taking a really definitive, clinically focused journey deep inside the ear.
Yeah.
This isn't just a quick review. We're really aiming for this to be a comprehensive study guide, you know, a structured reference tool.
Right.
For truly understanding the anatomy, the pathologies, how they cascade, and, well, the rigorous assessment techniques that really dictate informed practice.
Right.
Our mission is to get beyond just memorizing facts and actually build a deep understanding of this vital sensory system.
That's right. And the source documentation we've pulled together is, well, it's incredibly dense. It spans everything from the basic physics of sound conduction right through to, you know, specialized tuning fork tests and risk factors.
It's a lot.
It is. So our objective really is clear.
Yeah.
We need to distill the essential knowledge. Focus on those high-yield clinical reasoning pearls, the things that help you tell one diagnosis from another. We want to turn this huge amount of data into something manageable, actionable insights for you.
And what's really compelling is the level of detail we have available here. I mean, from genetic differences in earwax, believe it or not, to explicit lists of major ototoxic drug categories.
Mm-hmm.
This deep dive is about connecting all those dots, those isolated facts, into a coherent clinical story.
Yeah, making sense of it all.
Okay, let's unpack this. Starting with the fundamental structure that makes hearing possible, the incredible engineering of the ear itself.
Okay, so we usually approach the ear in three main parts, like architectural domains.
Yeah.
First up, the external ear.
Right, the visible bit.
Exactly. That includes the pinna, or auricle, the part you see, and then that S-shaped tunnel, the external auditory canal, or EAC.
Okay.
And the EAC is basically lined with modified sweat glands. They produce cerumen.
Earwax.
Earwax, yeah.
Yeah.
Its main job is protection. It lubricates the canal, traps dust, dirt, little foreign things.
So that external pathway, it just dead ends at the eardrum, the tympanic membrane, the TM.
It does. And that TM marks the boundary to the middle ear. You could argue the TM is, well, the most crucial landmark we'll talk about today.
Why is it so central?
It's the clinical centerpiece, really.
Yeah.
The TM's job is to take sound waves traveling through the air and turn them into mechanical vibrations.
Uh-huh.
So when we look at it with an otoscope, normally it should look pearly gray, kind of translucent, and slightly concave curved inward a bit.
And you can see things behind it.
That's the translucency.
Yeah.
You can often see structures like the handle of the malleus bone. And clinically, you are always looking for that cone of light.
The reflection.
Exactly. It's where the otoscope's light bounces off that concave surface. If that reflection is dull or distorted or just gone, that immediately signals something's wrong, usually pressure or fluid building up behind it.
Okay, so past the TM, we get to the middle here. It's just a small air-filled space.
Right.
But it's got those tiny bones.
It's a remarkable bit of biological mechanics, yeah. It holds the three tiniest bones in the human body, the malleus, the incus, and the stapes. Collectively, we call them the auditory ossicles.
Ossicle.
These little bones act like a series of levels. They're designed to efficiently transmit and actually amplify the very delicate vibrations the TM picks up.
So they bridge the gap.
They do. They transmit the sound waves from the TM across to the third domain, the inner ear. Specifically, they push against a little membrane called the oval window, which leads into the fluid-filled inner ear. This mechanical transfer is vital.
And the whole system needs pressure regulation. That's where the often troublesome Eustachian tube comes in.
Yes, indeed.
What's its main job? Because, you know, this tube seems to be the culprit in so much pediatric ear trouble.
Its function sounds simple, but it's critically important. Pressure equalization.
Okay.
The Eustachian tube connects the middle ear space directly to the nasopharynx.
Back of the throat area.
Right, the back of the throat. And every time you swallow or sneeze or even yawn, this tube pops open for a split second.
Why?
To make sure the air pressure on both sides of the eardrum, the PM, stays balanced.
Ah, okay.
Now, if this tube gets blocked, say, from swelling caused by a cold or allergies or maybe enlarged adenoids back there, things go wrong.
How so?
The middle ear cavity starts to absorb its own air. This creates a pretty strong negative pressure, which pulls the TM inward. That's called retraction.
Ow.
And it often leads to fluid being drawn from the tissues into that space, setting the stage perfectly for otitis media, an ear infection.
And that explains why kids are so prone to it.
Exactly. Children have shorter, more horizontal Eustachian tubes compared to adults. It just makes it easier for fluid to get trapped and harder for it to drain.
Okay. So once those mechanical vibrations have made it across the middle ear, we hit the inner ear. Or the labyrinth. This is where the real magic happens, converting it all into nerve signals.
Precisely. The inner ear is the sensory conversion center. It's a bony labyrinth containing fluid-filled structures. The cochlea is the main organ of hearing.
Like a snail shell.
Looks just like one. And deep inside the cochlea is the organ of Corti. That is the true sensory organ. It's lined with thousands of tiny hair cells.
Hair cells.
These hair cells are incredibly sensitive. They transduce or convert the fluid waves caused by the spapes pushing on the oval window into electrical impulses. These impulses then travel along the cochlear nerve towards the brain.
And the inner ear isn't just for hearing, right? It's also our balance center.
That's correct. The inner ear also houses the vestibule and the semicircular canals.
The balance part.
Yes. These canals are arranged in three different planes. Think of like up, down, side to side, and tilting. They detect head movement and your position in space.
So they help keep us upright.
They help maintain both static equilibrium, knowing where you are when you're still, and dynamic equilibrium, tracking your movement. The sensory information from these balance organs forms the vestibular nerve. This nerve then joins up with the cochlear nerve to become cranial nerve number 8, the acoustic or vestibulocochlear nerve.
Okay, got the structure down. Now, let's really focus on the pathways of sound transmission, because understanding these definitions seems absolutely key to figuring out the clinical tests later on. It's all about how the sound actually gets to that cranial nerve 8.
Absolutely. The main route, the most efficient one, is air conduction, AC. This is what we usually just call conductive hearing.
Okay.
The whole process we just mapped out. Sound traveling through the air, vibrating the TM, getting passed along the ossicles, and finally stimulating the inner ear fluid.
So if there's a problem along that path,
then you have a conductive hearing loss. There's some kind of physical issue, an impairment, or a block somewhere in the external or middle ear. It prevents or just reduces how efficiently those vibrations reach the cochlea.
Like a plumbing problem.
That's a great analogy. Think of a blockage. Maybe earwax impaction, fluid from otitis media. Maybe the ossicles are fused together, which happens in otosclerosis, or even just a hole in the eardrum.
Okay. Conductive loss is blockage. What about problems with the receiver itself? That's sensorineural hearing, right? Sometimes called perceptive hearing.
Exactly. This pathway involves the inner ear, the cochlea, the organ of Corti, and cranial nerve 8. So a sensorineural loss, SHL, means the damage is actually to the delicate receiving equipment.
The hair cells, the nerve.
Yes, damage to the organ of Corti hair cells, or to CNA gout itself, or even further up in the auditory processing centers in the temporal lobe of the brain. This type of loss, unfortunately, is often permanent. Common causes are things like aging, significant noise damage, or certain medications.
You mentioned a third way sound gets in, bone conduction, BC. What's that about?
Bone conduction is kind of like a shortcut. Sound waves can actually bypass the external and middle ear completely. They travel directly through the bones of the skull, causing vibrations that stimulate the fluid in the inner ear directly.
Does that happen all the time?
It does, yeah. It's less efficient than air conduction, definitely, but it's always happening in the background, sort of augmenting our normal hearing. But most importantly for us today, it becomes a crucial diagnostic tool.
For the tuning fork tests.
Precisely. The Weber and Rinn tests use bone conduction to help us figure out where the hearing loss is located. Is it conductive or sensorineural? It helps differentiate the type of damage.
Okay, that structural framework really sets the stage. Let's widen the lens now and look at the sheer scale of hearing health issues around the world. The statistics you pulled from the sources are, well, they're pretty arresting.
They really are. They paint a picture of a massive public health crisis, honestly. The WHO estimates something like 466 million people worldwide live with disabling hearing loss.
Disabling hearing loss.
Yes, meaning it significantly impacts their daily life.
Yeah.
And what often gets missed in that huge number is the pediatric side. 34 million of those affected are children.
Wow.
And when hearing loss is disabling in childhood, it has profound effects on language development, social skills, educational achievement. Mm. It really becomes a generational issue.
What I found fascinating in the source material was how it links genetics and even culture to specific risk profiles, starting with something as basic as, well, earwax.
Yeah, cerumen type is actually genetically determined. There's sort of a split. Populations with European or African ancestry typically have what's called wet cerumen, sticky, brownish.
Okay.
Conversely, people with East Asian, Native American, or indigenous backgrounds often carry the gene for dry cerumen. That tends to be more flaky and grayish.
And clinically, we just need to know that both are normal, depending on heritage.
Exactly. You need to recognize both variations as normal findings based on the client's background. Don't mistake dry cerumen for something pathological if that's their genetic type.
And this cultural context, it goes beyond just earwax, right?
Yeah.
Particularly when it comes to susceptibility to infections like otitis media.
Yes, absolutely. The sources highlight that certain indigenous populations, they mentioned the Maoris in New Zealand as an example, have statistically higher rates of otitis media, or OM.
Why is that?
Well, it's complex. Specific genetic links are still being researched. But it seems to be a combination of factors. There might be subtle anatomical differences, maybe in the angle or the function of the eustachian tube.
Okay.
But that's often compounded by socioeconomic factors, things like environmental exposures, poor air quality, maybe crowded living conditions, and sometimes limitations in access to early and high-quality health care. Mm. It really shows how auditory health is never purely biological. There are layers of influence.
Right. And on the inspection side, just quickly, we should mention that normal congenital finding Darwin's tubercle.
Oh, yes. Good point.
That little thickened bump on the outer rim of the ear, the helix.
Yeah, it's a small, thick prominence.
Yeah.
It's important to know it's just a normal variation, completely benign. Mm-hmm. It's a key, nice-to-know detail, so you don't flag it as something abnormal during an exam.
Right. Okay. Now let's focus on age-related changes. These are obviously central to geriatric assessment. The big one seems to be presbycusis.
Yes, that's by far the most common form of hearing loss we see in older adults.
It's often just described as age-related decline, but what's actually happening pathologically?
So presbycusis is a gradual sensorineural hearing loss. It typically starts becoming noticeable around age 50 or so. It's basically caused by the cumulative effects of wear and tear, cell death within the organ of Corti over a lifetime.
And it affects certain sounds first.
Critically, yes. It typically hits the high-frequency sounds first. This is why older adults often say things like, I can hear you, but I can't understand you, especially in noisy places.
Why is that?
Because they're hearing the lower-frequency vowel sounds okay, but they're missing the crisp, high-frequency consonants like nip, nip, nip. Those are the sounds that give speech its clarity.
Makes sense. Now, there's also otosclerosis. That's different, right? It's more structural and often shows up in this age group, too.
Otosclerosis is distinct because it causes a conductive loss, not sensorineural.
Okay.
It involves abnormal bone growth. Specifically, the bone grows around and immobilizes the stapes, that last tiny ossicle in the middle ear, right where it connects to the oval window of the inner ear.
So the stapes get stuck.
Essentially, yes. If the stapes can't vibrate freely, it can't efficiently transmit the sound vibrations into the inner ear fluid. It creates an obstruction to sound transmission.
What other physical changes do we typically see in the aging ear?
Well, the tiny cilia that help move cerumen out can become more rigid. This makes it harder for the ear to self-clean, which leads to impaction of cerumen that's often harder and drier than younger people.
Anything else visible?
You might notice earlobes becoming elongated, just due to loss of elastic tissue over time. The eardrum itself, the TM, can sometimes look a bit cloudy or slightly atrophied, and the bony landmarks behind it might seem more prominent. These are generally considered normal aging changes, as long as they aren't causing symptoms.
Okay, let's get into the comprehensive list of risk factors. This seems absolutely critical for client education and preventive counseling. You mentioned two main categories, general hearing loss and specifically otitis media.
Right. For general hearing loss, probably the most controllable risk factor is noise exposure.
Take one.
Huge. And it covers a wide range from continuous occupational noise, like in factories or construction, to recreational noise, like loud concerts, motorcycles, even things like using power tools or firearms without protection. Mm. And then there's acute acoustic trauma, like from an explosion.
What else?
We also have to list heredity some hearing loss runs in families. Age, as we discussed with presbycusis, direct trauma to the head or ear. And illnesses that cause very high fevers, like meningitis, can sometimes directly damage the cochlea.
But the category that seems most critical for us in clinical practice, especially for test scenarios, involves ototoxic medications.
Absolutely essential. We need to know these categories cold because identifying them during history taking is crucial. The sources explicitly flag several groups.
Okay, let's list them.
First, aminoglycosides. These are powerful antibiotics like gentamicin. They are highly ototoxic, often causing irreversible sensorineural damage. They basically destroy the hair cells in the cochlea. Careful monitoring with peak and trough levels is vital.
What's next?
Salicylates, like high-dose aspirin. Toxicity here often manifests first as tinnitus, ringing in the ears, which can sometimes be reversible if caught early.
Okay.
Then loop diuretics, like furosemide or Lasix. These can cause temporary hearing changes, especially if they're given too quickly intravenously.
Right.
Certain chemotherapy agents, particularly cisplatin, are well known to cause permanent dose-related sensorineural hearing loss.
Any others?
Yes. Quinine and related anti-malarial drugs are also documented to cause auditory side effects, including both tinnitus and hearing loss.
So the clinical pearl here is really about vigilance.
Absolutely. Any new complaint of tinnitus or any perceived change in hearing, especially in a patient who is hospitalized or recently started on one of these drugs, demands immediate investigation. It might require adjusting the dose or switching medications if possible.
Okay, that covers general hearing loss risks. Now, let's pivot to the risk factor specifically for otitis media, OM. This is mostly a pediatric concern, right?
Predominantly, yes. Mm-hmm. And the risk profile is almost like a checklist you can use when counseling parents.
What are the key factors?
Young age is number one. The peak incidence is between 6 months and 2 years old, largely because of those developing horizontal eustachian tubes.
Okay.
Attending group childcare settings, daycare, preschool where respiratory infections spread like wildfire.
Makes sense.
Bottle feeding, especially if the baby is fed lying flat on their back. This position can allow milk or formula to pool near the opening of the eustachian tube and potentially reflux up into the middle ear space.
Interesting. What else?
Exposure to poor air quality and secondhand cigarette smoke is a major one here. It irritates the respiratory lining, including the eustachian tube.
Any predisposing conditions?
Yes. Conditions like cleft palate or Down syndrome often involve anatomical differences in the head and neck that affect eustachian tube function. Also, having enlarged adenoids can physically block the tube's opening in the nasopharynx. Family history plays a role, too.
Okay, this brings us squarely into where clinical reasoning really kicks in, listening carefully, intently, to the patient's own story. If we don't nail the history, we're likely to misinterpret the physical exam findings.
Couldn't agree more. We have to start with asking about any fundamental changes in hearing.
Sudden versus gradual.
Exactly. We need to distinguish. A sudden hearing loss, especially if it's just in one ear, developing over, say, a three-day period that's treated as a medical emergency until proven otherwise.
Why emergency?
Because it could indicate something serious, like a vascular blockage affecting the inner ear, an acute severe infection, or even, rarely, a stroke manifesting that way. Needs immediate workup.
Okay.
And gradual.
A gradual, typically bilateral loss, especially if the person is over 50, points much more strongly towards presbycusis, that age-related change we talked about.
Got it. Next key symptom, drainage or otorrhea. You mentioned the quality of the discharge gives huge diagnostic clues, sometimes life-saving ones.
Absolutely. If the discharge is thick and purulent, meaning pus-like or maybe bloody, we're usually thinking about an infection, either in the external canal, otitis externa, or a ruptured eardrum from otitis media.
But there's a red flag situation.
The biggest red flag is when the patient reports clear, watery drainage, or maybe watery mixed with blood, specifically after head trauma.
Why is that so critical?
Because you must immediately suspect cerebrospinal fluid, CSF, leakage. A fracture at the base of the skull can tear the dura mater, the lining around the brain, allowing CSF to leak out through the ears.
Which is incredibly dangerous. Extremely. It creates a direct pathway for bacteria to get into the meninges, causing meningitis. Mm. If you suspect CSF otorrhea, you need to try and collect the fluid, test it on for glucose, or using a filter paper to look for the halo sign, and that patient needs immediate neurosurgical consultation, no question. Okay, urgent scenario noted. What about ear pain, ochalgia? You said it's not always straightforward. Pain can be referred.
That's a crucial clinical reasoning pearl, yes. True otitis media or otitis externa will cause primary ear pain, but the ear shares nerve pathways, specifically branches of cranial nerves, IX and X, with the throat, the mouth, the teeth, even the TMJ, the jaw joint.
So ear pain doesn't always mean an ear problem.
Exactly. If a patient comes in complaining of significant ear pain, but when you examine the ear, the otoscopy is perfectly normal, you have to broaden your search. Think dental abscess, tonsillitis, pharyngitis, TMJ dysfunction.
So you need a good pain assessment. You need the full Colditz PA workup. Character, onset, location, duration, severity on a 1-10 scale. Precipitating factors, associated symptoms. That detailed history is essential to start narrowing down those possibilities when the ear itself looks fine.
Okay, moving on to tinnitus. That perception of ringing or roaring, buzzing, crackling sounds when there's no actual external source, a lot of people just live with this, right? But it's important.
It's a critical symptom, yes. Tinnitus can be thought of as a barometer for auditory system distress. Sure, it can sometimes be caused by simple things like impacted cerumen or even high blood pressure.
But the big concern?
Its presence must always trigger a review for ototoxic medication use,
yep.
Especially if the tinnitus is new onset, particularly after starting something like high-dose aspirin or an amidal glycoside antibiotic.
And the clinical insight?
It's educating the client that tinnitus is often the very first sign of damage to the cochlea, potentially showing up even before we can measure any actual hearing loss on a test. It's an early warning signal.
Okay. Lastly, that feeling of spinning or being off balance, vertigo, this clearly points towards the inner ear's balance system, the vestibular system.
Yes. True vertigo is specifically the subjective sensation of rotational spinning. We sometimes try to differentiate our objective vertigo, where the patient feels like the room is spinning around them, from subjective vertigo, where they feel like they are spinning.
And the most common cause?
By far the most common cause is benign paroxysmal positional vertigo, or BPPV.
BPPV, what's happening there?
It's actually a fascinating mechanical issue. Inside the utricle and saccule part of the vestibule, there are these tiny calcium carbonate crystals called otoconia. Sometimes people call them ear rocks.
Ear rocks, seriously?
Yeah, yeah. Normally they sit where they belong, but due to maybe minor head trauma or sometimes just aging, they can become dislodged.
And float away.
And they can migrate into one of the fluid-filled semicircular canals where they don't belong.
Okay. So what happens then?
When the patient moves their head into certain positions, rolling over in bed is classic, these loose crystals move within the canal fluid. This movement abnormally stimulates the nerve endings, sending a massive incorrect signal to the brain that the head is spinning violently.
Ah, hence the vertigo.
Exactly. It results in these brief but often very intense episodes of vertigo, and it's frequently associated with significant nausea, sometimes even vomiting, because the balance system is so strongly linked to the gut. Understanding that mechanism from the history really guides your physical exam, especially the Romberg test.
Right. And before we even touch the patient, we need to tie in the lifestyle assessment. This is where we can catch some of those preventable risks we talked about earlier.
Absolutely. We need to ask specifically about noise exposure, both at work and recreationally.
Mm.
Do they operate heavy machinery, go to loud concerts, use power tools, firearms, and crucially, do they use hearing protection?
And cleaning habits.
Yes. We have to ask how they clean their ears. Are they sticking cotton swabs in there? Airpins? Keys? Because probably the number one cause of minor canal cuts or even accidental eardrum perforation is self-inflicted trauma from trying to clean improperly.
Good point. And swimming.
Swimming habits are critical for assessing the risk for otitis externa, commonly known as swimmer's ear. How often do they swim? Do they use earplugs? Do they dry their ears afterwards? All relevant history.
Okay, with all that crucial subjective information gathered, we finally move to the hands-on objective physical assessment. We start simply just by inspecting the external ear.
Right. You establish immediate baselines. The ears should look roughly equal in size, generally between 4 and 10 centimeters long in adults.
Yeah.
And they should be symmetrical.
And position matters.
Critically.
Yeah.
We check the auricle alignment. You imagine drawing a line from the outer corner of the eye straight back to the occiput, the bump on the back of the head.
Yep.
The top of the ear, the auricle, should touch or be very close to that line. And also, the ear should be positioned pretty vertically. within about 10 degrees of a straight up and down line.
And if they're not aligned properly? If they're low set?
That is a significant red flag, particularly if you see it in an infant or young child. Low set ears are frequently associated with other problems, like genitourinary tract abnormalities or various chromosomal defects, such as Down syndrome.
So it warrants a broader look.
Definitely. It signals the need to investigate for potential systemic congenital issues. It's not just about the ears at that point.
What other things are we looking for just by inspecting? Visible abnormalities.
You're looking for things like towhei. Remember those? Small, hard, non-tender nodules on the helix or anti-helix.
Uric acid crystals suggest gout.
Exactly. Their presence strongly suggests chronic, maybe poorly controlled gout. You're also scanning the skin carefully for any blocked sebaceous glands, cysts, any suspicious lesions. Remember, the ears get a lot of sun exposure, so basal cell or squamous cell carcinomas aren't uncommon. Look for signs of trauma, like bruising or hematomas.
And the cerumen.
Oh, no, the cerumen you can see. Is there any, is it excessive? Does it look abnormal? Maybe foul smelling, very sticky, unusual color. That could point towards infection or impaction.
Okay, inspection done. Now palpation, touching the ear. This is where you said we get that critical clinical pearl, the test triage, that helps narrow down the location of an infection even before we grab the otoscope.
This is high yield diagnostic efficiency right here. You gently palpate three specific areas, the auricle itself, the outer cartilage, the tragus, that little flap in front of the canal, and the mastoid process, the bony bump behind the earlobe. Normally, all three should feel soft and be non-tender.
Okay, so what are the pearls?
Pearl one, otitis externa, OE, triage. If the client reports significant, maybe even exquisite pain, when you gently move the auricle or press on the tragus, that strongly suggests inflammation inside the external auditory canal.
Why that specific pain?
Because the lining of the canal is swollen and inflamed in OE. Any movement of the surrounding cartilage puts pressure on that inflamed tissue and causes sharp pain. Diagnosis leans heavily towards OE or swimmer's ear.
Got it. Pearl 2.
Pearl 2. Otitis media, OM, triage. If there's tenderness when you press behind the ear, maybe over the lower mastoid area, but crucially, no pain when moving the auricle or tragus.
And the problem's deeper.
Exactly. The inflammation is likely deeper, residing within the middle ear chamber itself, or maybe involving the surrounding soft tissues. This pattern suggests acute otitis media.
Okay. And the third pearl?
Pearl 3, mastoiditis triage. If you find pronounced severe tenderness, maybe even some redness or swelling, directly over the bony mastoid process itself.
That's more serious.
That suggests a mastoiditis. This is a rarer but potentially dangerous complication, where an untreated middle ear infection has spread into the air cells within the mastoid bone. This requires urgent evaluation and treatment, often IV antibiotics.
Wow, that three-point check seems incredibly valuable as a quick initial sort. Okay, now for the core assessment technique, the otoscopic examination, looking at the TM. Let's detail the checklist again for a normal TM.
Right, you're aiming for the standard description. Pearly gray in color. Shiny translucent, so you can glimpse structures behind it. Slightly concave, curved gently inward, and intact, no holes.
And landmarks.
The bony landmarks, specifically the handle and the umbo, the tip of the malleus bone, should be visible through the membrane. And, of course, you must identify the cone of light reflection.
Where should that be?
It should be in the correct clock position. Roughly the 5 o'clock position in the right ear and the 7 o'clock position in the left ear, in the anterior inferior quadrant. We also ideally assess mobility using a pneumatic attachment on the otoscope. A normal TM should show slight movement inward and outward with gentle puffs of air.
Okay, that's normal. Now, if the TM is our window into the middle ear, what abnormal findings, visual diagnostics, can we actually see? Let's run through the common pathologies again based on appearance.
Okay, first, acute otitis media, AOM. The drum won't be pearly gray. It'll be dramatically red, maybe fiery red, intensely inflamed, and it will be bulging outward because of the pressure from fluid and pus behind it. The cone of light will likely be distorted, decreased, or completely absent because the bulging shape ruins the reflection.
Okay, red and bulging is AOM. What about serous otitis media, SOM?
That looks distinctly different. The membrane itself might appear more yellowish or amber, and it will also likely be bulging, but the key feature here is often seeing visible air bubbles or a clear fluid level behind the TM.
Like looking into a fish tank.
Kind of, yeah. It clearly indicates fluid buildup, but usually not infected pus. This happens when the eustachian tube is blocked, leading to that negative pressure and fluid transudation, often called glue ear.
What about a hole? perforated TM.
You'll see a visible hole or rupture in the membrane. It might be small or large, often with irregular edges. This can happen when the pressure from untreated AOM gets too high and bursts the drum, or from direct trauma like the cotton swab injury we mentioned, or even a slap to the ear creating sudden pressure change, burr trauma.
And the opposite of bulging, retracted TM.
Right. Here, the membrane is pulled sharply inward. The bony landmarks, like the malleus handle, might look unusually prominent, shortened, or distorted because the drum is basically shrink-wrapped over them. This indicates significant, probably chronic, negative pressure in the middle ear, meaning a severely obstructed eustachian tube.
Any other colors we might see?
A blue or dark red TM, sometimes called hemotympanum, indicates blood behind the eardrum. This is almost always a sign of significant trauma, often associated with a head injury, particularly a basal skull fracture. Needs urgent investigation.
And finally, scarred TM.
These usually appear as irregular white patches or streaks on the surface of the TM. They're essentially scar tissue left over from previous severe infections, or sometimes from where ventilation tubes, ear tubes, were previously placed. Usually these scars themselves don't significantly affect hearing.
This detailed visual assessment is powerful. Now, this leads us logically into the more specialized hearing tests, particularly the tuning fork assessments that help us differentiate the type of hearing loss conductive versus sensor and neural.
Right. We typically start with a whisper test. It's a quick, easy, functional screening tool for hearing acuity.
How is it done?
You stand about 2 feet behind the seated client so they can't read your lips. You have them cover or mask the ear you're not testing. You exhale fully to make your whisper quiet and consistent, and then whisper a common two-syllable word like baseball or cupcake.
And the pass-fail.
If the client fails to correctly repeat 3 out of 6 different whispered words after giving them 2 tries, that constitutes a failed screening. They require referral for formal audiometric testing. And remember the tip, test the ear the client reports as being better first. This helps establish their baseline hearing ability.
Okay, whisper test is the screen. Now, the Weber test. This uses bone conduction to check for lateralization where the sound seems loudest.
Exactly. You strike a tuning fork, usually 512 hertz, gently, then place the bass firmly on the midline of the client's skull, either the center of the forehead or the very top of the head works.
And ask them where they hear it.
Yes. Where do you hear the sound? In the right ear, the left ear, or in the middle? Normally, the sound should be heard equally in both ears or described as being in the middle of their head.
Now, the abnormal interpretations, these are crucial clinical pearls, but sometimes confusing. Let's break down the logic.
They can seem counterintuitive at first, but the physics makes sense. Abnormal result 1. Sound lateralizes to the affected poorer ear. This strongly indicates a conductive loss in that ear.
Why would it be louder in the bad ear?
Because the conductive block, like wax or fluid, is actually preventing ambient room noise from getting into that ear via the normal air conduction route. This lack of background noise essentially unmasks the bone-conducted sound in that ear. The bone conduction bypasses the blockage, and without competing room noise, it seems louder on the block side.
Okay, blockage makes BC seem louder in that ear. What's the other possibility?
Abnormal result 2. Sound lateralizes to the unaffected ear. This indicates a sensorineural loss in the poorer ear.
Why?
Because the problem here isn't a block, it's damage to the inner ear, cochlea, or the auditory nerve, CNA, on the affected side. That damaged ear simply cannot perceive the sound efficiently, even when it arrives via bone conduction. Therefore, the sound is perceived predominantly or only by the healthy, unaffected inner ear on the other side.
Okay. Weber helps point towards conductive versus sensorineural. Now, the Rinne test. This directly compares air conduction, AC efficiency, versus bone conduction, BC efficiency, in one specific ear at a time.
Right. The Rinne test helps confirm or clarify the Weber finding for each ear individually. You strike the tuning fork again.
Step 1.
First, you place the vibrating bass firmly on the mastoid process behind the ear being tested. Instruct the client to tell you the instant they stop hearing the sound.
Okay, for bone conduction. Then what?
The moment they say they can't hear it anymore via the bone, you immediately move the still vibrating tines of the fork close to, but not touching, the opening of their external ear canal.
And ask,
can you hear it now? Testing air conduction. Mm. They should normally be able to hear it again. You ask them to tell you when that sound stops.
So what's the normal finding?
Normal finding. Air conduction ACAC is heard longer than bone conduction BC. Often stated as ACBC, typically about twice as long. This makes sense because the entire middle ear system is designed to amplify sound coming through the air route efficiently.
Okay. Abnormal interpretation 1.
Abnormal interpretation 1. Conductive loss.
Mm.
In the affected ear, the result will be BC is heard longer than or equal to AC, BC OAC.
Why?
Because the conductive block, Rax, fluid otosclerosis, is impeding sound getting through the ear canal and middle ear, AC pathway. But the sound can still reach the inner ear perfectly fine via the mastoid bone, BC pathway, bypassing the block. So bone conduction seems relatively better or longer than the blocked air conduction.
Makes sense. Abnormal interpretation too.
Abnormal interpretation too. Sensor neural loss. In this case, the result is usually still AC-BC, similar to normal. But the crucial difference is that the overall duration of hearing for both AC and BC is significantly shortened compared to a normal ear.
Meaning?
It reflects the overall inefficiency of the damaged inner ear or nerve. It simply can't perceive any sound well, regardless of whether it arrives via air or bone. So while AC might still be slightly more efficient than BC, both are markedly reduced.
Okay, Weber and Rin together give you a pretty good picture of the type of loss. Lastly, for the objective tests, we assess equilibrium using the Romberg test.
Right. This is primarily a screen for problems with the vestibular system, our sense of balance, although it also involves proprioception and vision.
How is it performed?
You ask the client to stand with their feet close together, arms at their sides. First, they do this with their eyes open for about 20 seconds. You observe for any significant swaying.
Then
you have them maintain that same position but close their eyes. Again, observe for about 20 seconds. Stand close by to prevent a fall.
What's considered abnormal?
Minimal slight swaying is normal. But an abnormal result, or a positive Romberg sign, is when the client shows significantly increased sway, starts to lose their balance, has to step out to catch themselves, or actually falls only when their eyes are closed.
What does that indicate?
It suggests that they are relying heavily on vision to maintain their balance, and when that's removed, the underlying vestibular dysfunction, inner ear balance problem, or possibly a problem with proprioception, sense of body position from nerves in the limbs, becomes apparent. A positive Romberg definitely warrants further investigation, often referral to neurology or ENT.
Okay, now let's really synthesize all this. We'll transition into linking those objective findings we just discussed back to the full disease process, the pathophysiology, and then talk about the appropriate management strategies and pearls.
Sounds good. Let's start back with the external ear pathologies. We mentioned otitis externa, OE, or swimmer's ear.
Right.
The pathophysiology there is usually that water gets trapped in the external auditory canal after swimming or bathing. This changes the normal acidic pH of the canal, washes away the protective layer of cerumen, and creates a lovely, warm, moist environment that's perfect for bacteria, or sometimes fungi, to grow.
And the key clinical link, the giveaway on exam.
As we discussed in the triage pearls, that's significant, often severe pain when you manipulate the tragus or pull gently on the auricle. That's highly suggestive of OE. Management usually involves topical antibiotic or antifungal eardrops, sometimes with a steroid to reduce inflammation, and importantly, keeping the ear dry until the infection resolves.
Okay. And what about the most common cause of temporary conductive hearing loss? Cerumen impaction.
This is purely a mechanical blockage. As you noted, it's particularly common in older adults. Why? Because those tiny cilia hairs lining the ear canal, which normally help migrate wax outward, tend to stiffen and become less effective with age. The cerumen itself might also become drier and harder.
And management. This seems like an area where people can cause harm trying to fix it themselves.
Absolutely. Safety is paramount here. The source material really emphasizes careful professional removal if it's causing symptoms. This might involve using softening agents, first things called cerumenolytics, like mineral oil, baby oil, or specific carbamide peroxide solutions to soften the wax.
And flush it out.
Followed by gentle irrigation with warm water. Only if you are certain the tympanic membrane is intact. You never irrigate if you suspect a perforation.
And the big don'ts.
The major safety pearl, really hammered home the sources, is the absolute prohibition of improper self-cleaning methods. Particularly using cotton swabs, they almost always just push the wax deeper and can cause trauma. And the other one is ear candling.
Still see ads for those sometimes.
Yeah. There is zero scientific evidence that ear candling provides any benefit whatsoever, but there is evidence that it carries a significant risk of injury, including burns to the ear canal or face, and even eardrum perforation from dripping wax. Just don't do it.
Good advice. We also mentioned seeing abnormal growth in the ear canal during inspection.
Yes. Exostosis, sometimes called surfer's ear. Mm. This is an abnormal benign growth of bone within the canal itself. It's typically linked to chronic exposure to cold water or cold air irritating the bone, hence the name. It requires that specific history link. A polyp seen in the ear canal is usually a fleshy, often reddish growth. It typically arises from underlying chronic inflammation. Seeing a polyp should raise suspicion for long-standing chronic middle ear infection, CSO, or possibly even the presence of a cholesteatoma deeper inside, eroding outwards. Needs further investigation.
Okay, let's move inward now to the middle and inner ear pathologies. We talked about acute otitis media, AOM, presenting with that red, bulging eardrum, often self-limiting, but the risk is it becoming chronic.
Exactly. If AOM infections are very frequent, or if one doesn't resolve properly, maybe due to antibiotic resistance or poor eustachian tube function, it can progress to chronic suppurative otitis media, CSO.
How is CS defined?
Generally, it's defined by having a perforated tympanic membrane along with persistent or recurring drainage, otorrhea, from the middle ear lasting longer than, say, 2 to 6 weeks, depending on the specific definition used.
And the major complication associated with CS?
The most feared complication is the development of a cholesteatoma.
What exactly is that?
It sounds like a tumor, but it's not truly cancerous. It's actually a skin cyst, basically. A sac lined with keratinizing squamous epithelium, skin cells, that develops in the middle ear or mastoid space, usually originating from the eardrum retracting inward.
Why is it destructive?
Because as this cyst grows, it accumulates layers of old skin, keratin debris, inside. It produces enzymes that are highly destructive to the surrounding delicate structures. It can erode the ossicles, leading to permanent conductive or mixed hearing loss. It can erode into the facial nerve canal, causing facial paralysis. It can erode into the inner ear, causing vertigo or sensorineural hearing loss. And it can even erode upwards into the skull base, potentially leading to serious intracranial complications like meningitis or brain abscess.
It often needs surgery.
Very often, yes. Surgical removal is typically required to prevent these devastating complications.
Okay, given the complexity here and the prevalence of some of these issues, this final segment focusing on interprofessional management and client education seems really vital. This is the why should I care or what can I do application part.
Absolutely. Prevention is key where possible. Let's start with noise safety again. The general rule of thumb that came out of the sources is pretty simple. If a sound is louder than a typical washing machine, you should probably be using hearing protection.
That covers a lot of ground.
It does. Concerts, lawn mowers, power tools, leaf blowers, many occupational settings. We need to normalize the use of hearing protection, whether it's simple foam plugs, custom molded plugs, or earmuffs. And just encouraging people to take breaks from loud noise environments whenever possible allows those delicate hair cells in the cochlea a chance to recover.
And you mentioned preventing childhood infections having broader implications for hearing.
Definitely. This is where public health measures and primary care are crucial. We rely heavily on timely childhood immunizations, making sure kids get vaccinated against measles, mumps, and rubella, MMR, significantly reduces the risk of those illnesses causing high fevers or direct viral damage that can lead to sensorineural hearing loss.
What about congenital loss?
For preventing congenital hearing loss, screening pregnant women for infections like rubella and syphilis is standard critical practice, as these can affect the developing fetus's hearing. Genetic counseling can also be relevant for families with known hereditary hearing loss.
Okay. And finally, let's reiterate those critical safety takeaways regarding ear care and when to seek help.
We can't say it enough. Do not overclean your ears. The ears are generally self-cleaning. And absolutely do not insert anything smaller than your elbow into your ear canal. That means no cotton swabs, no keys, no hairpins. The goal is gentle external cleaning and non-interference with the canal itself.
And referral triggers.
For any persistent or concerning symptoms, ear pain, otalgia, any drainage, otorrhea, bleeding, sudden hearing changes, vertigo, persistent tinnitus, the clear instruction is always seek medical evaluation. Don't ignore it.
And if our screening tests in the clinic are abnormal?
If the whisper test indicates a deficit, or if the Weber or Rinne tests show abnormalities suggesting either conductive or sensorineural loss, the immediate next step should be a clear, unambiguous referral to an audiologist. They can perform definitive, quantitative audiometric testing in a soundproof booth to precisely determine the type and degree of hearing loss.
So collaboration is key.
The collaboration between the primary care provider, the ENT specialist, otolaryngologist, and the audiologist is absolutely crucial for effective diagnosis and long-term hearing management.
You know, the real value of this kind of deep dive, I think, lies in seeing that entire causal chain. linking the subjective report like a client saying they get brief, intense dizziness when rolling over in bed directly to the likely underlying mechanism, BPPV, with those dislodged otoconia, and then anticipating the objective findings, like maybe a positive Dix-Hallpeck maneuver during the exam, and knowing the potential treatment like the Epley maneuver.
Exactly. That integration is clinical reasoning. It allows you to anticipate what comes next. You know that a confirmed conductive loss needs investigation to find and address the obstruction, whereas a confirmed sensorineural loss might require strategies like hearing aids, assistive listening devices, and counseling on communication tactics. It moves the whole process way beyond just memorizing lists of symptoms and findings into true clinical comprehension.
It really is astonishing when you break it down how meticulously engineered the ear is. It's not just our primary way of sensing sound, but it's also integral to our orientation, our balance. And as we saw, it can be an unexpected mirror reflecting systemic health issues, from gout revealed by tophi to genetic syndromes linked to ear shape, or even life-threatening head trauma indicated by hemotympanum.
Indeed. It's a complex and vital system, and it requires and frankly deserves our meticulous assessment and attention.
You know, our sources consistently brought up that hearing loss isn't just a physiological impairment. It can severely impact social functioning or overall quality of life. It's linked to increased risks for things like cognitive decline, social isolation, depression, withdrawal.
That impact is profound.
So given that, and given the incredibly high prevalence of preventable noise exposure that contributes so much to sensorineural loss, whether it's from our jobs or just blasting music recreationally, maybe the final provocative thought for everyone listening is this. What single concrete change could you implement today in your own daily routine, maybe even outside the clinical assessment room, to better protect your own hearing long term and help safeguard that quality of life? That's the challenge we leave you with.